and 600 warplanes in the event of the collapse of Basra. The Soviet Union also expressed its concern over the continuation of the war and stressed that the war had to be eventually ended with negotiated settlements. Perhaps the Iranians will never forget the statement of the Secretary of Defense, Caspar Weinberger. Weinberger said, "Iranian people should be exterminated by cutting off Iran's oil production so that the war will be over." And years later, Secretary General of the United Nations, Javier Perez de Cuellar, wrote in his memoirs, "Following the adoption of Resolution 598 in July 1987, the United States definitely believed in order to end the war, 1. The Iraqis had to firmly stand against Iran's victory. 2. The war had to be more painful for Iranians than any other time. 3. The flow of weapons to Iran had to be reduced through another resolution within the Security Council. And 4. There had to be a great deal of international pressure on this country." In 1987, the Persian Gulf was the scene of the confrontation between Iran and the United States of America, in which many heartbreaking and painful incidents took place. In the spring of 1988, Iran was going through a tough situation. After the fall of Al-Fah, the U.S. government announced that it would support not only Kuwaiti and Saudi ships, but also other countries' ships and, in general, shipping in the Persian Gulf. They officially announced that all Iranian leaders had to know that the continuation of attacks in the Persian Gulf would not be tolerated.
On the morning of July the 3rd, we were coming back through the Straits of Hormuz on the way to pick up another ship for an Ernest Will escort mission. And there was some radio communications indicating sounds of explosions or such coming from Montgomery and Vincennes.
German merchant Ulugari, this is U.S. Navy warship. We are standing by channel 1-6. Over.
Okay, 1-6. Do you read me?
Merchant Ulugari, this is U.S. Navy warship. We need you loud and clear. Over.
Okay, thank you.
On the morning of July 3rd, Captain McKenna, chief of the U.S. Naval Operations Center, was startled to discover that Vincennes' cruiser had moved away about 64 kilometers from where it was supposed to be. Then he promptly ordered Vincennes and Montgomery back south to their original location.
It was our concern, however, that Vincennes was acting in an overly aggressive fashion, or so it seemed, and that they were actually pursuing these boats rather than being pursued by them. The IRGC were sort of a ragamuffin band, if you will. I mean, they were not very well coordinated, and certainly it wouldn't be too difficult to scare them, I don't think, into doing something that was foolhardy. If they saw a lot of military machinery bearing down on them, they could easily become frightened. It was our business out there to defend shipping against those guys, but not to provoke them. We don't know how close to the boats the helicopter actually went. There was, without getting too technical, a fixed distance that they were supposed to maintain. If, in fact, they were harassing the boats, which may have been the case, how would the boats communicate with them? Well, they would generally fire warning shots. We'd seen that happen with news helicopters there in the past. If the news helicopters or the media helicopters got too close to Iranian small boats, bog hammers, if you will, or whatever, warning shots would be fired and had been fired in the past.
An American helicopter pilot informed William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, that Iranian gunboats had fired at his helicopter. Rogers ignored the return order, moved towards Iranian territorial waters, and convinced Captain McKenna to authorize him to shoot Iranian boats. At 9:49, the Vincennes opened fire on Iranian boats.
Zero is inbound.
350 relative.
Relative.
Still inbound.
The warning shots, or were they actually attacked? The helicopter wasn't hit, after all. And the helicopter could escape the area at great speed, and in fact it did. So, therefore, what was Vincennes up to in going to general quarters, accelerating to maximum speed, and heading off to those boats, which at the time presented no threat to anyone?
I did not send the Vincennes to support the Montgomery. I authorized the Vincennes to send their helo. I was the only one that was in authority to send them anywhere, and my understanding was that they had asked permission to cover the area with the helicopter, and that they were also told to remain on station. Management at the time specified, and they were very clear-cut, that you will return fire with fire. And so they asked permission to take the units under fire. I gave permission and reported the same to Commander of Mideast Force.
In Bandar Abbas Airport, 274 passengers of Flight 655 from Bandar Abbas to Dubai boarded the plane so that pilot Mohsen Rezaian and his colleagues would fly them to Dubai. The Airbus, a passenger plane, took off at 10:16 after a short delay and was supposed to land at Dubai Airport in 28 minutes.
During that engagement with the small boats, the aircraft lifts off from Bandar Abbas and then proceeds on course, essentially, slightly off schedule, as has been noted. I think they were 20 minutes or so behind schedule, climbing on a fixed course, using the proper IFF and so forth and so on.
The Vincennes sailed into Iran's territorial waters in pursuit of Iranian boats by 10:22. And violated maridime law.
Officer Deck, President, hold the ship, crossing the Iranian-declared war zone line.
We did take the 12-mile limit seriously. Everybody was very concerned about it. Incurring into the 12-mile limit was verboten, and people were supposed to hold short of this 12-mile limit by several miles to prevent that from happening.
Aircraft was proceeding on a course that would take it directly over the Vincennes position. Recall again that Vincennes was in the middle of a gun battle with these small boats. Now, perhaps a battle of its own making, but firing nonetheless.
When I briefed in with the commander of the Mideast Force, I know that a very serious concern of his, as a matter of fact, he said, Dick, the one thing that I am concerned about is shooting down a civilian aircraft.
The Iranian passenger plane was ascending when the Vincennes crew saw it on the radar screen. The Airbus A300 passenger aircraft did not look like the F-14 Tomcat. A passenger plane is much larger compared to a fighter plane, and it also flies slower. However, the Vincennes crew believed that they had mistaken this giant plane for a tiny F-14 Tomcat.
I was told that it was an F-14. I watched it. I took a look at its altitude and its speed. It was climbing. It was slow. It was in the middle of our missile envelope. The F-14, to my knowledge, had no significant anti-surface warfare capability, so I designated this thing in my own mind as a non-threat. Captain Rogers, on the other hand, involved with his gun battle at that time, announces that he is intent on taking that aircraft out at 20 miles. It's climbing, it's slow, it doesn't respond. It's in the middle of our missile envelope, basically. It's vulnerable. Why would this aircraft present a threat? It did not meet any of the threat parameters that were. If Captain Rogers believed it was a military aircraft, and if he believed, as we think he did, that it was part of a coordinated effort at that point, a coordinated attack, then in his mind, he could see this as a threat.
Tense. It did make the situation much more complicated.
Both ships had attempted to communicate with the aircraft, and we were unsuccessful. We got no response back.
We could hear the challenges go out on military air distress and the civilian version of the air distress channels. So we were aware that they were warning an aircraft, an approaching aircraft.
typically, if you could not communicate with an Iranian airplane, military aircraft, you illuminated them with your fire control radar, you let them know that you were there, and they would generally depart the area. When we illuminated it with our fire control radar, it didn't react.
I did not have the capability to talk directly to the commanding officer of Vincennes, simply because he was engaged on a very personal basis in a fight. And I knew they were about ready to pull a trigger on a missile that could kill my pilots, and I wanted to make absolutely certain that they didn't become the victims.
Air hostile at 004, true, 21 miles.
The aircraft crosses the 20-mile mark, and he doesn't shoot it down. At that point, I breathed a sigh of relief, thinking that, okay, he has now seen that it is a non-threat.
Size is right here?
Size.
Okay.
What I'm told transpired during that period of time afterwards is that they weren't capable of getting the shot off in an orderly fashion. So although the intent was to shoot it down at 20 miles, they sort of bungled the operation.
William Rogers, the commanding officer of Vincennes, requested a permission from the command center to open fire on the Iranian fighter jet. The soldiers and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser became increasingly nervous when they heard about a possible attack by the Iranian fighter jet, and fear fell upon them all. The Iranian passenger plane was ascending, though a fighter jet does not need to get high to attack an aircraft, and it is capable of attacking the target so quickly. The passenger plane sent the codes that indicated it was not a fighter aircraft, and they could identify the aircraft based on the communications between the pilot and the watchtower. However, the commanding officer of Vincennes said they received no codes from the passenger plane, so that he decided to shoot down the plane. A few minutes later, 18th minute into the flight, the passenger plane disappeared from the Vincennes radar screen, and the crew of the American cruiser started embracing each other. They did not know that their happiness would soon fade away, and that was the bitterest day of their lives, the bitterness of which would always remain in their minds. A few meters away, there were 108 women and children among the 290 people who were killed. An eyewitness says, while collecting the bodies of the passengers, we saw a woman who had hugged her child. She was hugging her so tight, the baby was stuck in her arms. We would not separate them. A child who had thought it would take less than half an hour to get off the plane at Dubai Airport.
We had individuals who were up in places where they could see wreckage fall and they could see the airplane coming down. It wasn't until sometime later that they described the wreckage in terms that led us to believe that it was not a military aircraft. It was too much, too large.
An Iranian Airbus is presumed crashed. Please look for survivors or aircraft wreckage.
I killed over the entire force. They spent a considerable amount of time. There was nothing there. And it's also fairly ironic that the Vincennes is the one that came upon the wreckage when it started to become apparent that this was an airliner that was involved. It was just a sickening feeling for the entire rest of the day. I can't ever remember being so dismayed, so depressed, so feeling for all of the people that were involved. It wasn't a very happy day in the Gulf for us, that's for sure. The SIDES was dispatched to go close to Dubai to see if they could find wreckage. And firstly,
the Americans announced that they had shot down an Iranian F-14 Tomcat. And once the truth came out, they claimed that the Iranian plane had deviated from the flight path and had ignored all 7 radio warnings issued from the Vincennes. Later on, it became clear that the Iranian plane was ascending along a legal flight path. 4 years after the incident, the New York Times wrote, "It was a Vincennes cruiser that illegally crossed into Iranian territorial waters. However, American officials have covered it up."
After receiving further data and evaluating information available from the Persian Gulf,
We believe that the cruiser USS Vincennes, while actively engaged with threatening Iranian surface units and protecting itself from what was concluded to be a hostile aircraft, shot down an Iranian airliner over the Straits of Hormuz. The U.S. government deeply regrets this incident. Given the threatening flight profile and the decreasing range, the aircraft was declared hostile. Vincennes fired two standard surface-to-air missiles, at least one of which hit at an approximate range of 6 miles. An examination of the events on 3 July leads quickly to the conclusion that Iran must share the responsibility for tragedy and the investigation so found. By any measure, it was unconscionable to ignore the repeated warnings of the United States and permit an airliner to take off from a joint military-civilian airfield and fly directly into the midst of the ongoing surface action in the Strait of Hormuz, which the Iranians themselves had initiated.
The United Nations Security Council, July 16, 1988. An emergency meeting was held at the request of the Iranian representative to the United Nations to review the incident of the passenger plane being shot down. Iran's foreign minister and U.S. representative George W. Bush spoke at the meeting. Bush told Mr. Velayati, "This would not have happened if you had stopped fighting the war." He continued, "Minister, I am telling you that you need to choose between ending the war and confronting us." The war had become painfully torturous for the Iranians, and Resolution 598 was accepted 2 days after the Security Council meeting and the Airbus incident. On July 20th, 2 days after the adoption of the United Nations Security Council resolution on the crash of a passenger aircraft, a resolution was issued. A resolution that only expressed regret about the occurrence of that incident and included a few general statements in its other paragraphs. It also contained some recommendations concerning the prevention of future incidents and supporting research by the International Civil Aviation Organization. Iran simultaneously requested an emergency meeting from the Security Council and asked the International Civil Aviation Organization, ICAO, to initiate the investigations. However, the final report of the ICAO was nothing beyond the Security Council's statement. They condemned the incident and offered some ethical recommendations.
Everybody interviewed in the combat center said that the plane was descending toward the Vincennes. But the electronic record shows it never descended toward the Vincennes. But everybody had that view. I mean, they totally deluded themselves as to the nature of the threat.
Later on, Iranians filed a formal complaint with the International Court of Justice at The Hague. The results of the Security Council meeting and the ICAO investigations had already shown that there would be no better ending to this case in The Hague as well.
Perhaps at the time of the ICAO release, we should have declassified the ship's position and issued a press release pointing out Vincennes' location within Iranian waters at the time of firing.
I spent an immense amount of time, probably the bulk of my time, looking at all the tracks and the various documentation that had been done on the tracks, and how uncertain that evidence is.
How do you explain, Admiral, the discrepancy that everything started in response to distress calls, and yet the Fogarty report later confirmed that it turned out that there were no distress calls?
I don't think I can explain, Congressman. I think he misspoke.
Mr. Fogarty?
Yes. I've talked to him about it. He doesn't remember it. I cannot reconcile it.
The reason why there was no final report is exclusively my fault. We didn't produce any further document, although we wanted to, and I got bogged down with something else that erupted. I forget what it was. The biggest problem you have in doing any investigation is the guy who commits the mistake, or whether it be an honest error or whether it be a grievous error, lies to his superiors to cover his own butt.
The commanding officer and crew members of the Vincennes cruiser received the U.S. Navy Medal of Honor once they completed their mission in the Persian Gulf. The passenger plane's case was closed after the agreement. However, history still remembers it, and every year people honor the memory of the travelers who never arrived at their destination.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program The Key here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be examining a question which is kind of relevant to what we're all afflicted with right now. And that is the global pandemic, the coronavirus, which is spreading all over the world. The question is this. We know that today doctors are advising all human beings to distance themselves from one another in order to avoid the spread of this virus and in order to help prevent it from spreading faster than it already is. A question that comes into mind is that, does this have any precedent in Islamic history, or can we find any basis of this in Islamic medicine, traditional Islamic medicine, or not? This is an interesting question. We can analyze this from a number of points of view. Historically, we know that this isn't the first time that such a pandemic has occurred in human history. This has occurred both on a global scale before, as well as in certain local districts and certain local areas of the world, many times in history. In fact, as we might have mentioned in some of our previous sessions, historians have even written books specifically about this subject. For example, a historian has written a book called At-Ta'un fil Arab, right, regarding spread of the plague amongst the Arabs. Right now, we're not concerned with this part of the of this dimension of this problem. Right now, we want to see whether this has a basis, some sort of basis within traditional Islamic medicine. And the answer to that is that we don't see any direct reference to this within Islamic medicine, but we can derive certain indications from it, from certain traditions and as well as certain references in traditional Islamic medicine. For example, in certain traditional texts of Islamic medicines, there has been an advice to leave a land in which a disease is spreading. This doesn't necessarily prove that it doesn't directly mention that one should, for example, stop congregating in mosques or stop coming together in religious gatherings. But nevertheless, this concept of social distancing, it can be referenced from this. Also, there are certain references in Islamic traditions and hadiths to leave this land, a land which is plagued with a certain virus. For example, Muhammad ibn Yaqub al-Qulayni in Al-Kafi, he makes a reference to this in volume 8, page 108 of this book. He makes a reference to this. Also, Sheikh Hore Amili in Wasail al-Shi'a, he makes a reference to this concept in volume 2, page 429. If you look at this in this place, you can see, you know, this reference to this concept of social distancing or foregoing a land in which a certain plague is or a certain disease is spreading. This is one way that we can reference this concept in Islamic medicine. So this is one way that we can examine this question, and we see that this concept of social distancing, it has a foundation and a basis in traditional Islamic medicine and as well as the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt alayhim wassalam. So therefore, it's not totally unprecedented, and it has a certain Islamic nature to itself. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at social distancing in the time of the coronavirus and its Islamic nature. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in southern Africa via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran. Or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
In the limelight.
Exiled American whistleblower Edward Snowden recently joined global critics who are decrying news outlets for encouraging war with their coverage of rising tensions between the United States and Russia over Ukraine, says Jessica Corbett, journalist, in an article published under the heading "Nothing More Grotesque Than a Media Pushing for War," says Edward Snowden. Stay tuned for more. Exiled American whistleblower Edward Snowden recently joined global critics who are decrying news outlets for encouraging war with their coverage of rising tensions between the United States and Russia, where he has lived since 2013, over Ukraine. "There is nothing more grotesque than a media pushing for war," Snowden tweeted. He said, "When you see snide, quote, tweets of this from boot-licking think tank crowd, look at the ratio and remember that even if they're loud, they are in the minority. Being pro-war is not smart, cool, or sophisticated, and their performative outrage doesn't change that." Snowden is far from alone in blasting a media march toward war that has been compared to the lead-up to U.S. invasion of Iraq in 2003. Jeremy Schill, co-founder of The Intercept, wrote in a recent fundraising email, here we go again. With talk of war in Ukraine rising to a fever pitch, U.S. media outlets are once again beating the drums. The investigative reporter who has covered U.S. wars for decades added, the talking heads on cable news are almost drooling over the prospect of ratings-boosting war. Retired Pentagon officials on the payroll of the defense industry are presented as experts, often with no disclosure of their financial conflicts of interest. And once shooting starts, mainstream pundits will drop any remaining pretense of journalistic integrity and begin openly cheerleading for the troops, like sports announcers rooting for the home team. Meanwhile, the United States regime is the world's largest arms dealer, and it spends more on defense than China, Russia, India, the UK, Germany, France, Japan, South Korea, and Australia combined. In a recent opinion piece for Middle East Eye, journalist Joe Gill wrote that in the 21st century, the media war is a critical element of any pre-war planning, and this appears to be reaching its crescendo. By talking up the inevitability of a war in Ukraine against Russia, Western intelligence agencies and their media outliers are implanting the idea that war has already started. He continued, noting that Bloomberg even accidentally announced that Russia had invaded Ukraine before apologizing. During White House press briefing, Jake Sullivan, Biden's national security advisor, said that Russian military action could begin any day now, citing what we are seeing on the ground and what our intelligence analysts have picked up. We are not saying that a final decision has been taken by Putin, Sullivan noted, while also emphasizing that any American in Ukraine should leave as soon as possible and in any event in the next 24 to 28 hours. The advisor also insisted that we are ready to continue results-oriented diplomacy that addresses the security concerns of the United States, Russia, and Europe, consistent with our values and the principle of reciprocity. However, the Biden administration has also signaled an unwillingness to agree to any of security demands, including Ukraine's exclusion from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, and deployed B-52 bombers with nuclear capabilities to the United Kingdom, as well as 3,000 more troops to Poland. A senior defense official said in a statement that the troops are being deployed to reassure our NATO allies, deter any potential aggression against NATO's eastern flank, train with host nation forces, and contribute to a wide range of contingencies. Noting that the U.S. and NATO are pouring in high-tech weaponry and training up Ukraine's armed forces, making it much more militarily capable foe, Jill wrote recently that from where the Russians are sitting, the deployment of billions of dollars worth of new U.S. and U.K. military hardware on its borders is a sign of escalation rather than defense. He added that the narratives repeated in the Western media are so thunderingly pro-Ukrainian and anti-Putin that it is hard to extract from the simplistic framing the complex nature of the conflict. Bruce Green delivered a similar critique last month in a fairness and accuracy in reporting analysis of the corporate media's Ukraine coverage, writing that missing context, including the crucial role the U.S. has played in fueling regional conflict, allows hawks to promote disastrous escalation of tensions. Green added, citing recent polls, as a result of this coverage, the interventionist mentality has trickled down to the public. Perhaps if the public were better informed, there would be more domestic pressure on Biden to end brinksmanship and seek a genuine solution to the problem. Meanwhile, as Branko Marcetic pointed out at Jacobin earlier this week, progressives who have taken a forceful stand for a diplomatic resolution to the Ukraine crisis, such as Senator Bernie Sanders, Representative Ilhan Omar, are navigating a dangerous climate created by mainstream media, including liberal outlets MSNBC that cast anti-war opinion as disloyalty. Journalists who are critical about a potential war between the world's two nuclear superpowers or even question Western governments' claims about a potential Russian invasion are also being met with hostility. Last week, as Common Dreams reported, Matt Lee of the Associated Press grilled a U.S. State Department spokesperson about the administration's refusal to provide any evidence backing up the claim that Russia is planning false flag operation as a pretext to invade Ukraine. Referencing the George W. Bush administration's infamous lies about weapons of mass destruction, Lee told the State Department's Ned Price that, "I remember WMDs in Iraq." As the journalist pushed for more than a series of allegations and statements, Price accused him of wanting to find solace in information that the Russians are putting out. Recalling the exchange, Gill said, "This kind of briefing can't help but recall," as Lee suggested, the feverish month in the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray five times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini al-Islami dini wal-Azam ghayru dini Muhammad illi hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We are going to be talking about the prayer rules according to the laws issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtaza Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching Makassas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching, one can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program, Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, host in this program, and Sheikh Javed, our dear guest speaker in this program. Well, we're going to talk about the rules and jurisprudential status of the prayers and some of its necessary or obligatory ingredients, such as muwalat, for example. Sheikh Javed, what does this terminology, muwalat, mean, in fact, in prayer? We all know that, you know, this is one of the obligatory conditions, if I'm not mistaken, correct me if I'm wrong. And without it, without muwalat, in fact, the prayer is going to be rendered void, right?
Yeah.
Well, can you explain and shed more light on the meaning of muwalat, the concept of muwalat, and how should one go about it?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Well, muwalat is one of the requirements of prayer which must be fulfilled.
Yes.
And if this requirement is not fulfilled, obviously the prayer which people, or let's say the people, the prayer which you offer will be affected.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what does muwalat mean? Muwalat means to offer the different parts of the prayer in quick succession.
No. Right.
They have to be offered and
in order.
And the words and ayat of the prayers should be offered in order in succession, in quick succession, not allowing any gap between one word or any other. So now a person, according to the religious authorities, a duty-bound person should maintain continuity, and I'm going to explain further, you see.
Mm-hmm.
Maintain continuity during prayers. In other words, he should perform the various acts of prayer, like, for example, ruku, sujood, tashahud, in continuous succession. And he should not, of course, he should recite the zikr, and also all the verses, because, like, for example, if you are reciting Hamd in Surah, there are verses that you need to recite. Those verses must be recited in the usual succession,
mm-hmm.
not very fast and not allowing a big gap between the verses.
I see.
And if a person allows, you know, an undue interval or gap between different acts and different parts of the prayer in a way such that you are not considered to be you are not seen as someone offering prayers, then your prayer will definitely become void. Now, if a person who is offering prayer forgetfully, for example, allows a gap between letters or words, and if the gap is not big enough, so that the form of the prayers is disrupted or disturbed. Of course, he should repeat the prayers, because mm-hmm. that is happening forgetfully and by mistake. So if a mistake happens, and if there is no deliberate act on the part of the person who is duty-bound, mm-hmm. and he allows a kind of gap between the words and the letters, then obviously he should repeat the prayers, unless he has moved on to the next rukun. Mm-hmm. Because a rukun cannot be repeated, it cannot be, you cannot add a rukun to the prayer.
Or deleted.
So, yeah, it cannot be, let's say, deleted or ignored under any circumstances. Mm-hmm. So if you have, for example, gone into sujood and you have made a mistake in the mu'alat or in the recitation of a zikr before the sujood, you cannot go back and you cannot, repeat the zikr, or you cannot make it up, you know. So you should ignore what has gone by or what you have already done, because the prayer is not affected. That's in the case of forgetfulness or if a mistake happens. But if you deliberately allow a gap between the different words and different acts of prayer, obviously your prayer will be affected and will be rendered invalid.
Uh-huh. Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Javed. Let's take a quick break and we'll be back. Don't go away. La ilaha illallah,
Allahu Akbar. The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program, Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio, with me, Muhammad Jad, hosting, and our dear guest speaker, Sheikh Javed. Well, we are talking about the very important topic, the pillar of Islam, prayer, the rules of prayer, according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And Sheikh Javed, before the break, you were talking about what Mawalat is or what it means, in fact, and you also mentioned that, this is kind of quick succession of or order of the acts and words of the prayer, right?
Yeah.
Well, but would you also tell our dear audience about, how would you compare the balance which we are required of offering and performing and observing in the prayer, for example, between the ruku and then the sujood, then you have to stand up, right? And you need to just pause for a little and then go for the prostration and sujood, right?
Yeah.
So how would you compare and contrast this kind of balance, this kind of short pause, and the concept that you said about muwalat, against which makes the prayer void? You said that if it is too long, then the prayer becomes void, right?
I didn't say that. I said that on the interval,
the interval between the two acts.
Is too long. In a way that you are not seen as someone praying, mm-hmm. you are just silent.
Yes.
Then, of course, your prayer becomes mm-hmm. void. But when it comes to prolonging your, sajda or prolonging your ruku,
yes.
and you are continuously reading or reciting a zikr, that prolongation, if I could term it, does not affect the prayer. No matter how long the sajda lasts,
yes.
or the ruku lasts, the act of prolonging the ruku and sujood will not affect the prayer.
Mm-hmm.
And also, if your ruku or sujood are very short, they shouldn't be as short as you will not be able to recite a zikr, because when you are because every the ruku and sujood are not only mere, you know, bending and going down and prostrating, okay? Mm-hmm. You have to recite a zikr. And when you are reciting a zikr, your body should be steady, your body should be motionless and should be still.
Mm-hmm.
And in the time of recitation, there should not be any movement, vigorous movement,
yes,
of the body.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, your prayer, as we discussed it in one of the previous episodes, the prayer will be affected.
Mm-hmm.
So during that state of steadiness, and when your body is steady, you should recite the zikr. You,
yes,
should recite the zikr. So that much steadiness should be there in order to allow you to recite the zikr. And when your body is moving, it's not permissible to recite the zikr, because steadiness is one of the essential conditions and one of the necessary requirements of the prayer, without which the prayer is definitely affected.
Shaykh Sawid, very quick answer I want you to just give our audience about the criteria or the rulers we have regarding prolongation of the ruku and sujood. How long can a ruku or a sujood, a genuflection or a prostration be?
Well, I should say that according to Supreme Leader, and based on what I understand from the fatwa of His Eminence, he gives a general fatwa saying that prolonging sajda and ruku does not break mawlat, it does not affect mawlat, but obviously the rukus and sujood should not be so long,
mm-hmm,
and so it should not be protracted so much to that extent that it's no longer considered, mm-hmm, an act of ruku, because ruku and sujood have their own formula, shape, and what people understand from ruku is to just bend down and do a respect for God, because you are facing God and you are communicating, mm-hmm, with Allah.
Okay.
And of course, it shouldn't be very long.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Thank you for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
لا إله إلا هو لا إله
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 41 meters, 7300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iransat or BAT 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastorday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.